Welcome to Mission Driven, a conversation about how startups leverage their social mission as competitive advantage. Mission Driven is hosted by Better Ventures, a seed stage venture fund in Oakland, California, backing entrepreneurs using science and technology to address the world's biggest challenges. You can find us on the web at better.vc and on Twitter at Better Ventures. Rohan Puri from Stable Auto, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
How's your Friday going?
Not too bad. A little dreary, a little cold.
All right. And where are you exactly?
New York City.
New York City. Which neighborhood?
Columbus Circle area. Just moved here.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
All right. Got it. And that's where you live and work?
Live and work. Yeah. A little bit of WeWorks here and there, but that's where most of the action's happening at home.
Okay. Got it. All right. Well, we were introed by Arno Harris, my friend and your business associate. How do you know him?
You know, it's funny. I don't actually recall how we met. It must have been an introduction from one of our investors. But you know, Arno's been in the electrification space, you know, since before it was cool. And
he's an OG, I would say.
And he's felt the pains. He has scar tissue, and so he was one of the first people we thought we should meet.
When I told him I was doing a series on electrification, your name was, I think, the first name out of his mouth. So, you're doing essentially charge point location math and software services. Do you want to maybe just say a bit about your background and how you got to Stable and what Stable is?
Yeah. So I've had a very roundabout background, which seems pretty typical for a lot of founders, but, school was biomedical engineering. University of Virginia. Eventually moved up to Boston, joined Techstars as an associate. That's kind of where I got my start in startups. And I was essentially helping startups build their first generation's products. That led me actually to MIT Media Lab. They're right across the street from one another, which basically means the professors would show up in Techstars all the time, or vice versa. You'd end up in the Media Lab for whatever reason, because it was all people working on new, fun, interesting technology problems.
Yep.
So it kind of turned into, is a little bit of roundabout way, but you know, I showed up at the Media Lab working on a sensor, just something I was prototyping on my own. I had read a paper that it would be really cool to build a touch sensor. This is before Touch ID, that could identify you from just when you touch it.
Oh yeah.
And I had been building
missed it by that much.
I know, missed it by a little bit. And I built a little mini prototype of it, and it caught the eye of one of the professors at the Media Lab. And he said, "Hey, this is really cool. Would you consider working on this here? That's like a research thing." And I said, "Yeah, that sounds great. I don't know if I'm qualified to work in MIT Media Lab, but how do I do it?" And he said, "Well, let me introduce you to a few people." And that turned into 6 hours of straight interviews with different people at the lab. And
no pressure.
No pressure. I just was not prepared.
One of the best technology labs in the world.
It was just so many interviews and you know, getting to know people. I was not prepared, right? This was all impromptu. And at the end of it, he said, "You know what? There's only two ways to join the lab. The first is that you apply degree program here, which you can do. Or the second is you find your own funding and you do it as a commercial research project here." And I said, "You know what? I'm not much of a test taker, so I'm going to do that." Went around, eventually got Google to fund my research for a couple of years. And it appointed me with a postdoc there to help me build this thing. And we raised money, like $500,000 of research funds to build a prototype of this sensor. That's how I met my co-founder of our current company. And we had just been working, back to back in that lab for a while, supporting all sorts of research projects, computer vision, biometrics, energy modeling stuff. He was doing some stuff on trillion frames per second imaging, which is crazy. Imagine imaging light as it's moving. That's how fast we're trying to catch. And we just got along quite a bit. But as you can imagine, we worked in a computer vision group. That was the main premise of our group. So we had a lot of attention from people working on cars, next generation vehicles, self-driving, LiDAR, hot topic. This is 2012, 2013, 2014.
Yep.
And so we were a lot of OEMs coming out to us with problems. And we realized that almost everybody was building some sort of self-driving electric fleet. So long story short, that led us to a connection with a guy named Kyle Vogt, who's the current CEO of Cruise. Maybe he's CTO now. I think he's CEO.
Yep.
And Cruise has
this is a self-driving car company bought by Chevy, and they're rolling out a service similar to an Uber, but autonomous, right?
Exactly. It's operating in San Francisco today, in most of San Francisco, actually.
Yep.
And
it's now open, isn't it? So you don't have to be in the beta or whatever. You can just
anyone can charge. They can again jump in these things, right? You just get in an account and go.
I've been meaning to go over there just to do that. So maybe I'll do that.
that's the way. I mean, seeing is believing, right? You see it and you're like, wow, this thing's real. Yes, it's limited to just the city and things right now, but you can see how it scales. San Francisco is no easy city to drive in. So
yeah, for sure.
But anyways, you know, that led to that connection. Kyle originally spoken to us about problems that they were encountering with their fleet, which was trying to plug them in. You know, and he basically said, hey, we have no way to plug in. There's no driver behind the wheel
right.
of these vehicles. And there's going to be thousands of these vehicles. How do I plug these, you know, how do I make sure these things are charged all the time? They're going to be charging at random hours of the day and random little depots, big and small depots across the city. I can't staff each one of those up. It doesn't make any sense for me. Can these dock with a charging station? Can you make a dock of some sort or some sort of charging mechanism? The car comes in, you plug it in, and then send it back on their way. And maybe there's some other things you could do for us while you're charging. Can you calibrate our sensors and do a little cleaning, you know, in there?
Clean the windshield.
Exactly, right?
Check the oil, as it were. Yeah.
Data dumping is a big one, right? How do I dump the data off of the, so much data stored in the car and the drives fill up. So
too much to transmit over the air in real time. Yeah.
So it was just a start was to think about charging, but that's where we said, hey, we can build a little arm that plugs these things in and just holds the charger. And so the charger is, very heavy. It's like 10 pounds. The cable's really meaty, very, very thick cable, very hard to maneuver and plug in even with your human hand. So getting a robot to do it was easier in some ways that we could lift weight easy, but it was harder in other ways and it was so inflexible.
And to be precise, it had to be really precise.
Yes, really precise. Has to sort of get in the socket pretty much directly because robots can't do what humans do, which is sort of jimmy it into the, wiggle your wrist a little bit until it kind of goes in there, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So we had built, much more precision into it and we charged a couple different makes and models of vehicles. We ended up, doing so well that the Electrify America, one of the largest charging companies in the United States, the second biggest after Tesla, said, hey, we're looking to build a robotically operated charging facility to serve these vehicles. We'll build the chargers. We'll put those in. If you guys can build the robots. I said, great. So we deployed the first facility. This was right around February of 2020 in a location in the Mission. A warehouse in the Mission, a robotically operated charging facility, and a couple of fleets lined up who were going to charge there. And then COVID hit. That pretty much put the brakes on everything.
Yeah. That's tough.
For everyone in the world, right? So we were lucky. We came out okay with our health personally, but to help this fleet get online, which is what we were trying to do, right? The whole point was self-driving cars need anything that can help them get to market faster. And we were going to do all the ops behind them. We could do it because they had a much bigger problem. They couldn't test, they couldn't deploy, they couldn't develop. We couldn't test, we couldn't deploy, we couldn't develop, right? We were stuck in. And so what was interesting out of that is it was a very hard time for us at Stable. Where are we going? What are we going to do? But also probably the best thing that happened to us. And I think in hindsight, it's only clear in hindsight as always.
So how'd you come up with the idea for Stable and then what is it?
Yeah, so that's from the real Stable.
Oh, I guess that was Stable. Yeah, so the current Stable, sorry.
Yeah, and that's what we actually, Stable has a couple different meanings. We want to bring stability to the world, right? That's our goal, is to bring stability to the world. We're a little bit of a climate change is really throwing things off balance, and we want to bring back that balance. But if you think about the other way, meaning of Stable is, the first form of big transportation was the horse. And where did horses go to sit and recharge? Well, they went to the stables. And we wanted that reliable, strong, dependent brand, right? A bedrock for this new move into autonomous electric ACES, as you see these days. So, in building this site, we built one of the first robotically operated charging facilities, actually the first that we know of. And Electrify America was this whole time asking us, where should we put the next one? Where do we think the second, third, fourth, and fifth ones should go? And it's going to be optimal for the fleets and optimal for us because we want a charging station that's being used. We don't want to just sit in there collecting dust. So where are they going to use it? Where is the action? And it was surprising that they didn't have any way to figure that out. That's what set us on a course of trying to use data to best inform where charging stations should go and wrapping it all in a software experience that made it just as easy as figuring out where to put a solar panel, where you just put it where the most sun is going to shine and the least number of shadows are going to go on it. We want to make it as easy as that to find a place for a charging station.
Say a bit about why that's hard. So it's not like locating a Starbucks. You have like time of day pricing, you have vehicle traffic, but vehicle state of charge, all these things. Like, why is it hard, and how is it that you guys do a better job?
Yeah, so let me give you the lay of land of this industry and what makes charging so difficult. So charging stations, a DC fast charger is a fast charger, right? It charges your car about 80% in 30 minutes. These are the big BP ones. The Tesla superchargers are DC fast chargers. Mm-hmm. They cost about $100,000 each for one charger. So you put 5 to 10 in a location, you rack up about $500,000 to $1 million of capital on a site that you're hoping people are going to use. This is not a solar panel. You know, this is much more expensive. And so before you put $1 million into a site, you want to make sure that this site's going to be used and you're going to make a return on that investment, $1 million of investment. So how do you figure out what the return on the investment will be? Well, you know, it's $1 million in. How much money are we going to make? Well, it depends how many people show up at the site, because you're charging by the kilowatt hour, the energy dispensed into your car, into your battery. And you're charging a margin on that energy. Okay, how many people are going to show up to this site? How much energy are they going to pull? Well, it depends on what makes and models of vehicles they have. And how much is that energy going to cost me to dispense to my customers' vehicles? Well, that's dependent too. It depends on where you put the site, which utility you operate in, and what that utility charges by time of day. You know, 8 to 10 a.m. is this price, 10 to 1, it's another price based on the time of day. And some tariffs have things called demand charges, which is hot in the media all the time these days, which basically means, you know, if in this 10 charger site, 10 vehicles show up at once for 15 minutes, you're going to be slapped with a massive bill. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars for a 15 minute mistake, because utilities hate spikes in usage. Yeah. They want steady flow and predictable usage. The more spiky it is, the harder it is, and they're going to slap you with a fee. So now you know how many people are going to show up. You kind of know roughly how much energy they're going to pull, maybe, and then you kind of know what that energy will cost you. And so you kind of know how much money you're going to make this year, but what about 5 years from now when there are a lot more EVs on the road?
Yeah.
How much growth can you expect in my site in San Francisco versus my site in Kansas City? Should I put fewer chargers in Kansas City? What about incentive programs? Well, Kansas City, do they have any good incentives that, you know, help me cover the upfront cost of my install? California, there's some great programs. 80% of the charger can be covered. $1 million, $800K can be covered. Depends where you are, what incentive programs. So the hard part is, what is the ROI of my charging station going to be?
Yeah.
And that's what everyone wants to get to.
Really, nobody knows. And it's a big math problem.
Big math problem. You're trying to predict the future that doesn't exist yet. And most importantly, you don't have much historical data to base it off of. So if you think about something very similar, in the solar space, this is a very straightforward problem. We know exactly, or we can estimate pretty precisely, how many sunny days a solar panel is likely to get in a city. Yep. It doesn't change that much year over year. And more importantly, we have like hundreds of years of historical data, or at least, you know, 50 years of historical data to be like, okay, you know, San Francisco has this many sunny days roughly per year. And so there's not much risk. And so when you finance a solar panel, it's actually very easy to finance and cheap.
Mm-hmm.
It's predictable. But a charging station, how are you supposed to know all these parameters? Right. And then what happens next year?
And if you spend all that money and they don't come, you're underwater fast. It's like building a hotel with nobody renting the rooms.
And that kind of gets us to like what we, you know, there are a lot of companies out there that are trying to bring this world to, you know, fully electric as soon as possible. Right? You can do that on the car side, you can do that on the B2G side, you can do that with battery storage systems and all this fancy software and tech that's out there right now today. Our way of going about it is to make charging a really strong value proposition, a strong revenue business, right?
Yeah.
And it's surprising, but the average utilization rate of a public charging station today is around 3 or 4%. 3 or 4% of the day, or around 30 to 45 minutes of the day, is a charging station actually being used on average.
Wow. Yeah, wow.
So they're not making money. Most are ROI negative, right? Their IRR negative. They're not going to pay back in their 7 to 10 year lifespan on any growth trajectory. And some of that is because of how the industry got here, which is a whole story in itself. But we basically put a lot of incentive dollars into charging. If you heard of the Dieselgate scandal from Volkswagen, right?
So they were rolled out, but no real thought given to their usage until they started to realize they now own that.
They own it. It's on their balance sheet for 10 years and they got to make something happen. So I mean, what's crazy is that we think that the secret here to encourage EV adoption is, okay, we need EV charging stations. And the government says, well, if we incentivize it, decrease the upfront capital expense, more companies will deploy charging stations because the returns will be better. We think actually quite the opposite. We don't think any incentives should be needed theoretically here, right? Mm-hmm. It should just be a good business. Gas fueling is a good business. It's a low margin business, but it's a good business.
Yeah.
Why can't the same be true for charging? You just have to be a little more clever about where you're putting them and how many chargers and how much energy you think you're going to dispense.
Yep. Great. So wait a minute. So I want to ask you in a minute here to say more about the industry in general of the charging industry, because I think there people listening will be really interested to hear, you know, more about the landscape and where it came from and where it's going. But first, I want to appreciate some of the things you said. Like, you're as an investor, you know, some of the things you said just really jump out at me as showing like incredible entrepreneurial hustle. You know, so like you joined Techstars, you know, as your first, one of your first moves, and that was a brilliant move. You got the funding for the fingerprints ID sensor thing, you know, because someone suggested it and you went out and found it and sort of funded yourself, right? And then Kyle, the founder of Cruise, comes along and you're listening and he's saying what he needs and you're like, oh, we could build that. And so you build that. And then that doesn't really work because of COVID. And then you pivot to something else. And, you know, what we find is, especially at early stages like you were at, pre-seed and seed, that nobody really has the answer yet. And so one of the core skills is being able to find the answer. And I think all those little adjustments and things you did there are evidence that you've got the type of skill set and mindset to do that. Aside from that, could you maybe take a step back, describe the charging industry? You know, when did it start? Who've been the big players? Where is it now? And we're just about to dump a ton of gasoline on the, well, that's a bad analogy. A lot of electrons on the fire here with the IRA to grow the industry further. So can you maybe give the context of all this?
Yeah. So, a lot has changed very recently. So I'll say that, but there's sort of been right around, I would say, 2008 timeframe, when we started to see some of the first few charging companies. It was the first climate tech bubble-ish timeframe, right, was there. And charging has actually been around for a while. In fact, one of the first cars ever made was an electric car, ever, right? So we've known about electric vehicles and their potential. Of course, those were like lead acid, liquid batteries that didn't hold charge for that long. We knew of it as an alternative. And in fact, gas kind of took off for a very, very strange reason. Has to do with like lobbying and the chemical industry.
Huh.
And,
that's interesting.
But we just didn't invest the time into it because we said, hey, this gas one seems pretty straightforward. Let's do that. Mm. But you think about it, like if you ever look at an engine and you're like, that is really complicated. This thing is that we built, right?
And it's exploding. It's exploding things.
It's an exploding, a chamber of complexity. And think about a motor of an electric motor, a copper coil.
A bunch of coils, magnet.
There you go. Pretty straightforward. So it's kind of crazy that we've kind of gone around this roundabout way. A little tangent here, but it's similar in like the TV industry. If you think about like the tube, the cathode ray tubes that we had in a TV, where it's like throwing these beams of light and trying to angle them and make an image. It's crazy to think that was the first invention of a TV when an LCD screen was like little blocks of color. And from far away, they look like a picture, right? That seems a little more obvious in hindsight, but
had we only had LCDs,
if we had something small enough, right? So anyways, back to charging. So, we've been seeing charging for quite some time, and it's always been sort of this niche, space where there was a very close-knit community of folks trying to deploy EVs and EV chargers. I think it really started to pick up that momentum with the Nissan Leaf. When the Nissan Leaf was introduced, it was like, okay, this is like a, EV, it was very short range. Mm-hmm. I think it was like 30 or 40 miles when it first came out.
Yeah.
But people saw the writing on the wall. They're like, this is reasonable.
Affordable. It's a little dinky. Yeah. Viable. Practical.
It was a little dinky. So it was really just like a city commuter car. And, you have to charge at home and there weren't really any public chargers at all. But we all know the story of Tesla and how they started taking it on themselves to make a longer range car that was affordable as well.
Yep.
And that's when we started to see charging stations to first emerge. And so then we started to see some smaller companies deploying chargers. This company called Better Place, which had this, historic...
I remember. It was president of SAP, right?
I don't remember exactly, but the individual had raised, I'm forgetting his name, Andre or something like that. But
But they were going to put batteries like from underneath the car, like swap out the batteries and put new ones in.
Yeah. They said, okay, yeah, range is low, but we can fix that by just swapping the battery almost instantly, just like you fill a car at a gas station. You don't have to wait and charge for 30, 45 minutes. And at that time, the charging time was hours, right? So we're talking about 6 hours or something. This was a big, you know, a lot of money poured into it. It didn't end up working. It has to do with like standards, compliance of cars and OEMs wanting to do everything their own way.
It was a little like the web van of your industry.
Yeah.
The one that everyone poured all the money into and didn't work. Yeah.
The issue has always been range. Like, it's always come down to, I can't believe I have to keep charging this thing over and over. Are there other solutions? It's one part of solutions is let's do a new kind of battery system. Another scope of solutions is let's make it more convenient to charge by charging with wireless in your home and on the streets and things like that. And then let's just make it faster to charge. Let's put more and more power. And so it's not hours, it's minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to reduce that burden. And it all comes down to range. Everything in the industry has been done. Mm-hmm. So then we started to see the emergence of companies. One of the first major companies out there was ChargePoint. They were selling ChargePoint chargers to individuals, businesses. You know, they're going after sort of niche fleet applications and even the general public with their Nissan Leafs and things like that.
EVgo
was an early one. EVgo came out of NRG. NRG had a scandal where they were mandated by the government to deploy EV charging stations. And they did. They deployed quite a few and they did a great job actually putting those charging stations. But of course, the mandate was to deploy a certain number of chargers by a certain amount of capital or chargers. I don't know exactly. By a certain amount of time. And what do? You optimize for that, right? You just deploy as fast as you can in places you think are reasonable, where you can get the power and where the permits are easy and where the friction is low. That's where you deploy chargers. Not necessarily where the ROI is high, because the point was not to make good ROIs, right? Then we had the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal. And this is when much bigger players start to emerge. Electrify America, $2 billion capital was mandated by the government to deploy into EV charging infrastructure by 2027, I believe. So they're just hand over fist flowing. And that's why they're now one of the largest. And of course, Tesla, the largest network charging stations, is very self-driven. Hey, this will help us ship more vehicles.
But you can argue all of this is just sort of basic 1.0 rollout. It's like a big chunk of hardware and you put a bunch of them out there and the cars will come. And so then, where are we now and how does that transition to like more intelligent placement of these things and even more intelligent routing of the cars so that they can recharge efficiently along the way and all of that.
Yeah. I mean, where we're at now, I mean, the first way was definitely, let's just put the chargers wherever we can, where it's easiest and cheapest, because there are no chargers. So there's no point optimizing, it's like, there's no chargers. If we put any chargers, it's a good thing.
Put them in a mall. Yeah.
Yeah. We're at the point now where there's so many companies deploying their own, selling chargers to businesses, retailers, apartment complexes, your home, right? You're getting, I'm sure, all the time, getting ads about this everywhere now. Incentive dollars are being poured into it. And now it's been, I think a lot of companies are trying to figure out, what is my differentiation? The hardware is getting into a place where it's getting more and more stable, right?
Yep.
I think, our opinion is that the hardware will eventually be pretty commoditized, right? You really care what charger you're charging at now. You care, it charges fast and it's cheap. That's about it. Just like you don't really care about the gas pump. We think the hardware will eventually be commoditized. I think a lot of the software and the smarts around the chargers themselves, actually, we think that will become pretty standard stuff too, in terms of it's going to be complicated, but will there be really big differentiators for you as a user to charge at one company's charger versus another company's charger?
Yep.
If you have a membership and you're tied to it, really, you're going to charge out of convenience most of the time. Yep. And if it's too expensive, you won't charge it. And that's really it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're at the point where, in a world where like, the software on the chargers and the experience of charging may not differentiate you. The hardware may not differentiate you. Where now it does, you have much faster chargers or it's more reliable. What is the long-term advantage of owning and operating charging assets? Well, it's the ones that get used the most. Just like the long-term advantage of a gas station. It's not the branding of the gas station or the pumps. It's is it a good place to fuel?
So I'm not going to the best experience charging station. I'm going to the one that's going to work, be the most convenient on my route and when I need it and where I need it.
Right now, it's a little bit more like, what's an easier experience? What's the more reliable site? Things like that. And we're seeing a lot of that still right now. We think eventually all of this sort of fades away. The chargers are reliable enough. The software experience is roughly the same for all of them. As a user with an app charging and paying, and there's plug-in charge now coming out where you just plug it in and it knows the ID of your vehicle and charges you automatically. There's no app. you know, anymore. So at that point, you know, what's to distinguish one company's charger versus the other? Well, the person who put the chargers in the places where demand is highest is going to make the most money.
Yeah. And there's also the commercial side of things too, right? So it's historically been the Leaf driver at the grocery store. And now you've got the Rivian Amazon truck that's going to be doing its route of, I don't know what, 110 miles in a day or something and need to charge, you know, along the way or whatever, right? And so do you see that as an opportunity as well?
Yeah. I mean, they're light, medium, heavy duty vehicles. We've seen companies emerge with trying to electrify drayage trucks. Mm-hmm. I have a crazy story back related to the robot arm stuff. We got reached out to, there was a guy in San Francisco. I don't want to name his him or his company, but he had a ferry. He bought an electric ferry.
Oh, geez.
Pretty successful independent business. He bought an electric ferry that he wanted to sell to San Francisco to operate a ferry service in the Bay Area. And it was, you know, relatively new technology, but in places like the Netherlands, for example, electric ferries are extremely common. In fact,
I rode on one in Iceland, I want to say. But Yeah.
They just do all electric ferries. And, you know, he had reached out to us when we were doing robotic arms because he said, you know, I have this ferry. The cable is, it's a 1 megawatt charger.
I've seen it. It's a monster.
It's, you know, like construction, you know, equipment tire.
Yeah. Like it's like a manhole cover comes out of the pier, the wharf, and just goes chunk onto the side.
Exactly. And they have this problem where they couldn't change the piers and the ports. And they're like, boat's bobbing up and down, but the charger is kind of rigid. And I have to somehow like lock it in place, charge it. And I have to turn around in about 15 minutes. I have to go back and go to the other because I'm shuttling back and forth. So there's
and
a
not fry all the passengers or all the fish.
Exactly. So you're like, hey, can you build a big version of your charger and plug our boat in? I don't know. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, I mean, every category of transportation, including these VTOL aircraft, right, are going electric. Uber was us about robotic charging of their, they had a 6-port, you know, charging system. And they said, hey, can you plug this in? So everything's, you know, pretty much any short trip stuff is electric at first. You know, for first, I think the only thing flying is long distance flying is gonna be hard. Rockets, obviously, possible. But we're seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. And then so the role of Stable then is now and in the future what? Helping companies choose locations that are the best ROI.
Correct.
And then where does it go from there? Do you just do that forever, or is it evolve into more and bigger and better?
Absolutely. The goal for Stable is we want to electrify. We want to make sure everything is fully electric. We're doing it by making charging a fantastic business. Right now, you talk to these companies, it's a very tough.
They're losing money.
They're losing money. Very bad business. So making a fantastic business by doing basically optimizing location with all of these parameters. What is the best location that taps into the most incentive programs, the cheapest cost of energy, the most usage of my site, right? And I put it all together to make sure that now and 10 years in the future, this site will remain a very powerful site, given that location will be the main differentiator in the future. The question is, eventually, most of the chargers in the ground, right? So at that point, what does Stable do?
There's no new ones to locate. The Starbucks is on every corner, so now...
Yeah, now what? You know, what do we need? What do we need Stable for? Well, that's where the interesting role, that's where the role of software and data comes into play, because unlike fueling vehicles, gas vehicles, where you're pumping liters and gallons, you're pumping kilowatts and kilowatt hours. And there's a difference, there's a big difference in dispensing a kilowatt hour in 5 minutes and dispensing a kilowatt hour in 10 minutes. So the speed of fueling impacts your charge. That is very different from a gas pump. A gas pump is just trying to dump as quickly as possible. As big as that hose could be, they're going to flood your car so you get out and they can get the next person in there. But in a charging station, you have now something very digital instead of physical. You have, talk about bits and atoms and stuff, right? We're trying to put atoms in cars. Now we're trying to put, we're using digits, right? We're trying to optimize energy, electrons going into
electrons,
a car.
Yeah.
And electrons, very different. The speed in which you put electron into a car is variable. And it takes more energy to put that electron into the car faster. So
It can also affect battery health and range and all of that if you are sort of nice to the battery as you go. Yep. Whereas if you just bombard the thing with energy, it can actually hurt its long-term functionality and cost a lot of money, right?
Exactly. So the energy, now the cost of that energy now depends on the speed at which you dispense it and when you dispense it throughout the day. And so that leads to all sorts of things. So this charger, when it's in the ground, it's now in the ground for 7 to 10 years, right? Depending on the make and model. You plan for a 10-year lifespan. And there are all sorts of things that have to happen to that charger. Did you know it costs around $7,000 a year per charger just to maintain the charger?
No, what do you have to maintain about a charger?
They break down all the time. You know, this is another funny story.
So it's break fix. It's not proactive per se.
There's proactive. There's regular
the cables or whatever. Yeah.
These are outdoor IoT assets, right? So they're outdoor interconnected things that are exposed to the elements and things break in the elements. They rust, they freeze over.
We've all gone to them and found them out of order, right?
Yep. They go out of order. They break. One interesting thing is a lot of charging networks, they try to make the financially smart plan here, which is, okay, we're going to buy, we'll sell you a modem on the charger to get data and do transactions and payments. We'll put a cellular modem on each of our chargers. I'm going to sign up with one provider, like AT&T. Because we get a bulk discount if we do it with AT&T. But guess what? AT&T doesn't have great coverage everywhere. No. So there are some chargers that just lose internet and then they can't charge a car because they can't transact payment.
Right.
Or they're in a parking garage where service is bad. And so they have to port Ethernet through. And so there's all these weird things that happen with chargers where the maintenance is quite high. So you pay $7,000 a charger a year in maintenance. You have to change your pricing throughout the year to maximize how much revenue you're going to make. How do you know what price to set? Well, it depends. What's your demand going to be at 3 p.m. in the afternoon? What's it going to be at 9 a.m.? How do you encourage demand at times when you want it and discourage it when it's most expensive to you? How do you set your pricing accordingly? So there are tons of ongoing tasks. There's carbon credit transactions. There's billing and tariff audits. Tariffs change. The utility, the price that you pay to a utility changes roughly quarterly. There might be a cheaper thing to pay. And you wouldn't know unless you're keeping track of it. So these are all the things that Stable wants to do. Again, all under the lens of maximizing revenue and ROI at charging stations to drive the best returns on charging stations as possible. We think if we do that well, we'll deploy chargers faster than any government incentive could.
Yeah.
Right now, we're really lucky to have them. And we want to encourage that, but we shouldn't need it for very long. That's the goal.
And we don't want to just dump a bunch of money and put things out there that don't work, because that's not helping anybody.
Exactly.
All right. Well, so generalize this, because the theme of this series of discussions, and this is the first one, maybe the only one on EVs, but generalize this to electrification more broadly. There's buildings, there's the grid, there's industry, and the role of software in it. I think you've said really pretty clearly that the hardware is commoditizing, right? It's been around a while. It works. It's a big chunk of metal, and there isn't that much to improve on the hardware, at least as far as we know. And now it's time for software to both improve the experience and help the companies make more money doing it, right? Talk about that. Like, how do you see, are we transitioning from a time when the hardware, it was all about the hardware, and now it's all about the software? And does that apply in EVs and in buildings and everything else?
I think we have, and we've kind of reached the point where we've done most of what we can. There's some innovation that can happen on the car side, bigger batteries and things like that. But chargers, you know, there's only so much you can make the plug, you know, be a plug. So we've sort of reached the point where the plug is a plug and it works and it does its thing. And yeah, it's maintenance issues and things like that. We'll work those out with time. But I guess the question is, we now have if you think about fueling your car with gas, what do you do? How do you decide which gas station to fuel at? Well, you go to a gas station that is convenient, is fairly priced, and there might be a competitor across the street. And you kind of just take the cheapest one, and you may not even go around to the competitor if it's too painful to do the return, right?
So or you ask Google. That's what I do.
Or you ask Google, right? And Google will tell you this one's cheap on your route. And cars are doing that, right? You get in your Tesla, and it will recommend a Tesla supercharger on the route that is optimal from where your battery capacity is and what the price of charging will be, and you should do it. You're going to run out of charge. We'll fuel you. We see this sort of pretty inevitable future where we now have a charger, which is internet connected and has a bunch of controls on it of how fast to dispense power and knows the price of energy at any given time. We have a bunch of vehicles, which are now also internet connected and have a bunch of intelligence on them about when to charge, what is current battery state of charge are. And these two networks, the chargers, the charging network, and the network of vehicles, all have to coordinate with one another, where they're each being as greedy as possible. The charger is trying to make as much money as possible, and the vehicle is trying to, you know, get to its destination by spending as little money as possible. But then we have this third thing, which is the grid. The grid is trying to normalize energy across itself and make sure that it's not too spiky and there's not
smooth
too much
load.
Smooth load, right? Yep. And so there's three sort of competing things here, and then you add the housing and on top of it that are all competing with one another to be individually as greedy as possible. And that is perfect for software. That is not something humans should be doing. That's not the guy going out on the sign out in front of your 7-Eleven and changing the price of gas there to do it. That is a computer.
It's Uber surge pricing. Yeah.
That's surge pricing. That is a computer to computer interaction that is managed like a stock market, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's buyers and sellers and demand and supply, and you're trying to triage them.
Airline tickets, same way, right? You come back to the site an hour later and the price has changed.
Exactly. And it's set up to be that way. Everything's internet connected. Everything is instantaneous response. Mm-hmm. You know, you run out of gas at a gas station, you got to wait for the truck to fill you up again. This, you just connect it straight to the grid. Everything is instantaneous. Yep. So that's and where we see the role of software.
And to circle back, it's software and it's data science, right? Which is a soft thing at the end of the day.
Right. Just like we use data science in high frequency trading, we use data science in airline tickets, demand pricing for Ubers, Lyfts. Data science is key to all of this, right?
Yep. And then I know you're not an expert on buildings or industry. You've talked about the grid. Do you see similar things happening there, or, you know, feel free to opt out if that's not your area?
I'm not as familiar with the buildings sort of grid side of things as I am with the vehicles and the charger side. But yeah, I mean, I think whatever we'll see, maybe we saw it first, the first glimpse of this was Nest, right?
Yeah.
Everyone thought Nest is just a thermostat, but actually it was an internet connected device that could in real time change the load on the grid. And that was like the first very public display of this. And now you have much bigger sources of power and draws on that power, vehicles and chargers. Like a fast charger can pull as much power in a single day as the average American home pulls in 6 months. It's no joke. This is not a Nest thermostat. Okay. This is like 6 months of that Nest thermostat.
Yeah.
In one day. So how do you maximize that? Well, it's the same. It's real time, you know, demand management and pricing and things to keep all of this in check.
I've even seen companies looking at like the sources of energy at different times of the day to find the cleanest charge. Have you heard about this, right?
Yep.
Can you say a bit about that?
Yeah. So there are ways to sort of source, and it's kind of an administrative hack is what I would call it. So, you know,
it's an estimate, right?
Yeah. It's an estimate.
Because electron's an electron. You don't know where it's coming from. But you can... Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
You're totally right. It's electron's electron. You don't know where it actually came from. But you can try to source it at times when the energy is more likely to be clean. So solar peaks during the day, obviously, not at night. So charging during the day is cheaper because there's excess demand of solar. You're more likely to get an electron from solar. And so what people do, they sort of mix and match energy sources. They say, you know, it's sort of like a market, an energy market, right? I buy energy from this solar provider. They gave me, you know, this many kilowatt hours, and I bought it from them, and I'm going to, you know, use that energy later for my Google server rack. I bought it from them. Even though it came from the grid, I bought it from them.
Yeah.
And so you sort of trade these kilowatt hours with one another. And that's what we see with, there's like something, a system called carbon credits, right?
Yeah.
Just a system sort of designed by policymakers to incentivize clean energy adoption. And they're saying, hey, you're you know, a company that's using a lot of energy. If you buy carbon credits, you can say that you've offset that energy and you can get tax advantages from it. So charging stations, you know, generate carbon credits. They offset the use of carbon because they're dispensing power into vehicles instead of fuel into vehicles. And people can buy those carbon credits from charging companies as an additional source of revenue. And this is available in California, Washington, Oregon to offset that revenue. That's another thing that Stable does. We estimate how much that revenue will be, but that revenue amount is actually like it's kind of like a crypto coin, right? It's like a carbon credits price is volatile. It has a market. There's a live tracker of it, right?
And so undetermined, right?
So you don't know how much revenue you're going to get from this thing at any given time.
But it's software that's trying to estimate and make a decision. So you're making the best decision you can.
Exactly.
With software. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then all that optimization stuff around clean sources and time of day, that's also software calling the shots and trying to determine what's out there generating what and how do I get the cleanest charge I can.
Exactly.
Anything else on software before we transition to mission and how it can be a competitive advantage in business?
No, I mean, I just think about it this way that, you know, we already are using all these vehicles and all these chargers are already using software to communicate with one another and do this balance. And just imagine as we pull humans more and more out of the loop of this process. So when getting back to our origin story, when everything is eventually autonomous, electric, shared, probably not everything will be, but most things will be eventually, right? Now there's no driver behind the wheel to even make the decision. It's entirely up to the vehicle. So there is no human in the loop at some point. And it doesn't matter that it's a convenient amenity. It's just, it's cheap now, I'm going to do it, right? That's it.
Maybe someday you can make a robotic arm. to charge these guys.
Exactly. I think we were too early on that one, but yeah.
You never know. Yeah. That would be hardware. Okay. So as you know, like aside from, this is a whole series of things on electrification, but the entire podcast series is about, the whole show is about mission as a competitive advantage, social and environmental mission. So do you want to say a bit, like, do you feel it is a competitive advantage for you? How does that manifest? Is it in hiring, in fundraising, in selling? Is it an advantage and how?
Yeah, I mean, I think in our case it is, but it's a little bit, we sort of go about it in a very, a little bit of an unconventional way. So the interesting thing about our business, about charging in general, is that it's full of climate change, you know, fighters. Like, there are people who have been in this industry for 15 years easily, just trying to fight this fight. And they're, mm-hmm. only now in the last 3 to 4 years have we really been seeing a turnover and something's happening, you know? So there's a lot of, you know, hardcore people who've been trying to fight climate change and trying to say, we need to go green. You know, it almost feels like, you know, back in the 90s, like the Amazon, you know, thing, or the ozone layer, you know, it was those same people who were fighting for us now and making it to a viable place. But actually, what we wouldn't be here without those people, but we really pushed it around the turning point, was the financials. Right? And capitalism as a mission is sort of like, hey, that's bad juju, right? We should do things to be good. But remember, like, you know, the Teslas and the Nissan Leafs and the people who made the car affordable has driven a lot of change.
And our for-profit businesses, of course.
And our for-profit businesses. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think there's a lot of like, no, we shouldn't, you know, be making money, or we should be doing what's best for the earth. But I think we can do both. And that's central to what we think about at Stable, is like, we make charging a great business. We might move way faster mm-hmm. than any incentive program could on its own. So that drives us in our sales process and our hiring and things like that. People are thinking, oh, this is a policy problem and like we should be mandating emission standards. And I said, what if I just make it an incredibly good business? Look how fast it could move.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't think people think about it that way.
Where do you put yourself in terms of passion for the environment and motivation, motivating you to do this?
You know, I think it's partially, obviously, I think it's kind of like the hot thing to be into fighting climate change mm-hmm. right now. I think a lot of people would say they're passionate about climate change, mm-hmm. just like a lot of people would say they're passionate about crypto even a few years ago, right? So mm-hmm. I think everybody, whether or not you think it's like you're passionate about the problem, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem that's going to affect everybody. We've all seen it. We've all seen it happen to us. So is this like, you know, my life's calling to fight climate change? I'm not sure it's my life's calling to fight climate change in particular. I just think it's an important problem that can be solved with skills that mm-hmm. we have. And, you know, this is not in the oil and gas is not something that I would ever support. I would ever be a part of, but moving them to this and showing them business value and charging is, and it's also something that a startup can do. Mm-hmm. This is not asset heavy stuff anymore. I'm not deploying chargers. I'm building software. I'm using data science. I'm giving you an app you log into, log in with Google and create your account. That's stuff we know. We're handling a lot of the math and the administrative burdens of finding these things and searching for them, right? But we're doing it in a way that enables this whole industry, people who have never deployed a charger in their life, to have some confidence in what the return on their charging station will be. That's what we do, right? We predict the mm-hmm. utilization of a charging station. So, you know, I'm not sure if it's a mission purely based on climate change. I think it's just a perfect combination of mission, something I can do, right? Something we can do at our team at Stable. And it's something that leverages like tools that we know. I mean, machine learning and AI is like the word for forever, but you know, we don't even say it in our sales pitch. We don't say we use machine learning. We just say, hey, we predict what it's, you know, what the utilization will be.
Yeah.
And we have this probability and these, you know, confidence levels. That's it.
You've been pretty successful fundraising, right? You raised a couple rounds, a series A and a round or two before that. You have some pretty prestigious, successful investors behind you. When when you were in those conversations, did you wear your enthusiasm for the environment on your sleeve? Did you lead with it? Did you hide it? How would you put it?
You know, I think in the first couple sets of pitches, I hid it. Mm-hmm. And no, it was a time when
closeted, you know, person who's passionate about the environment doesn't want to jeopardize the meeting.
Exactly. And it's sort of like, you know, with a lot of investor conversations, you know, you have to be careful of like bad words, quote unquote, right? It's just like bad memories. And everyone remembers the clean tech bust,
yep.
right? The bubble that burst. People remember Better Place, raised mm-hmm. $1 billion, right. And it went nowhere.
Yep.
And so leading with climate was just not as attractive as a proposition of leading with self-driving, autonomous at that time, mm-hmm. which was much hotter, right? So you have to change your verbiage.
Yeah, robots.
You have to change your verbiage according to what that is. And even now, we don't shy away from it as much, right? It's our, we talk about it very clearly, but we say it in a very different way, which is that, you know, capitalism can drive climate reduction, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, there's good money to be made. Mm-hmm. This is not a like do good for the world thing. It is, but you can also make money. And I think that is the lens that companies have been waiting for, and they've seen it a couple times enough now where they said, okay, I can see that this is not just another bubble that's about to burst.
So capitalism can drive results on climate. How about the other way around? Can like passion for the climate drive superior returns?
100%. That's what we can't forget that because that's what's got us here in the first place. When it made no sense from a capital perspective to invest in the EV, there was somebody at Nissan, some folks, a small team at Tesla that says it's going to cost a lot more. It doesn't make any sense, but eventually we'll figure it out. And it's those people who brought us to where we're at today. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have them, you know, to hell with optimizing or charging stations, you know, we don't have any EVs.
Yeah.
So you need that. You need that first fire starter.
And so it does work both ways. In other words, that the passion can drive superior. I mean, that's what we're banking on as our whole investment thesis, and it's working for us.
Exactly. And it's a passion, I think, is like twofold. Is it passion for the industry and the effect you're going to have in the world? Is it also passion for people and companies? And that's what, you know, I do all of our sales at Stable still to this day.
I noticed I was on your website, and when I click to learn more about, get a demo, your calendar and your photo comes up like to give to run the demo. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, we have quite a few customers, and I still do every sales call because, you know, half of sales is just empathizing with your customers. Mm-hmm. And you can just see they want to get into EV, they want to do EV charging, but they just cannot justify the capital. We're helping them justify. We're helping them say, you know what? There is a way to make money here. We're going to help you.
Yep. Cool. Well, anything else on mission? Any other thoughts on like the way the world's changing and people, you know, workers in the community are choosing companies to work for because of mission, or, you know, companies marketing very directly, you know, that they are good for the world one way or the other. Before we move on to other, our closing questions here.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, when we are screening for people at Stable and a phone screen for hiring, we ask them, you know, why are you looking for your next thing? Why are you interested in, and not specifically in Stable, but why something new? And I would say probably 7 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10, it's, I don't feel very motivated by what my company is doing. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe they have a great, very successful company that's making, you know, 50 million ARR 2 years, and they, you know, they do things like they make accounting simpler, mm-hmm. or they issue credit cards, or a lot of fintech folks actually we get. Mm-hmm. You're like, you know, I'm kind of tired of making money with money.
Right.
And I'm just wondering what the impact of my work will be on the world. And at least with you guys, I'm helping companies make money. It's sort of the same idea. It brings my skill set, but I see why it's important for the world in general, right? Now I'm having a positive impact. So that's a very, very common reason.
Yeah. Hear, hear. Yeah, we're seeing it. We're seeing it ourselves big time. We speak in front of a university class or something and say, you know, raise your hand if you want to work for a company that does good. And like every hand goes up, you know, and there've been surveys about, you know, views of young people on the role of a corporation, and a huge percentage of them say it's to do good and address the problems, the important social and environmental problems in the world, which, you know, 20 years ago would never have been the answer. We typically ask the same question in each of these about your personal mission. So if you were going to finish the sentence, Rohan is on a mission to what?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm on a mission to make charging a great business, because I think capitalism can do good. And right now it's not so fun. It's not so sexy to say capitalism is a good thing, but it can be.
Great. Rohan Puri, Stable Auto, on a mission to make charging a great business and show that capitalism can do good. Thanks for coming on. Great talking with you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Mission Driven. To find out more about Better Ventures, visit us at better.vc or on Twitter @BetterVentures.